Well, it's a great pleasure to be here, and I'm really looking forward to what Splitting the Sky is going to say next. And that was a wonderful presentation from Gunasitage. Apache or Blackhawk helicopters. Who was Blackhawk? Of course, the original Blackhawk stood up against the expanding United Statesian Empire. Maybe some would call it the American Empire, but in any case, in the War of 1812, as the United States was seeking to annex Canada, Black Hawk fought in that war. He was captured by a group of Native people who took him and took him to the American military, who incarcerated Black Hawk. And Black Hawk was taken on a trip to the eastern cities. The attempt was to overawe him, to demonstrate that there was no point resisting the United States, that the United States was going to spread westward. Of course, these could also be looked at as Apache helicopters. And of course, Apaches are among the most famous guerrilla warriors in the history of humankind. Some called them the leopards or tigers of the human race. They were terrific fighters in a certain resistance style. And of course, their most famous member, Geronimo, is one of the most celebrated Native American people. Geronimo was incarcerated for about 30 years. He was captured. He was taken out of his territory in Florida. He was transformed into kind of a tourist attraction. But they could never really explain what laws Geronimo had broken. Had Geronimo violated the domestic law of the United States? Was he a criminal according to the domestic law of the United States? Or was he a prisoner of war? And if he was a prisoner of war, of course, then the international law would come into play. So what we're seeing in Guantanamo Bay, where some might call them freedom fighters, some might call them terrorists. It's always a difficult call. But in any case, the idea that you designate a group of people as savage, as a risk to the society, as so violent that the laws can't be extended to them, I'm going to argue tonight that we've seen a long history of this. And it really goes back to the Declaration of Independence. I'm going to argue tonight that the War on Terror really starts on July the 4th, 1776, when the Declaration of Independence was given. And this is not rhetoric. I'm quoting now, and if I had a more accurate thing, if I could watch on a monitor here, I could show you the words in the Declaration of Independence. Of course, this is one of the most famous and uplifting political manifestos in human history. The idea of declaring the equality of men. They didn't say women, they were sexist at the time, but in those days they declared the equality of man. They declared every man has a right to life, liberty, and pursuit of happiness. Given the context of Europe in those days, That was a big step forward, and I think we have to acknowledge the good things about the Enlightenment, the concept of universal human rights. But the most of the Declaration of Independence, which was primarily written by Thomas Jefferson, is a list of accusations against King George III. If you can think of King George III as a sort of Saddam Hussein, the ultimate diabolical figure of his time. Of course, in war propaganda, it's much easier to demonize an individual. So in explaining why this revolt was going to take place, and explaining why there was a revolt against the British Empire, and why the American rebels, who of course, if they had not succeeded, they would be terrorists, right? They took up arms against a duly constituted authority and laid out their different allegations against King George III. And at the end of this list of allegations is the precise wording, is he did bring on the merciless Indian savages whose known means of warfare is indiscriminate destruction of all ages, sexes, and conditions. So I'm quoting now from the most famous manifesto of human rights, probably the most consequential single document in world history, given, you know, the significance of the United States to every person on the planet right now. King George brought on the merciless Indian savages whose known means of warfare is undistinguished destruction regardless of age, gender, and condition. So there's your war on terror. We have these wonderful declarations of human rights, a concept of universal liberty, but then there's an escape here. There's a group that don't get the law, that are so prone to violence. You know, this is the original racial profiling. Every Indian is merciless, every Indian is savage, and obviously you're criminalized right off the bat. So the very indigenous peoples who were on the land that the United States fully intended to take over were declared from the very beginning of the Republic to be outside the law, to be essentially terrorists, to be racially profiled, and we've seen that repetition. We saw it through the Cold War. The United States, there's always this provision that you can take the law away, that you declare the universal liberties, but it's not really universal. There's always the indigenous peoples, essentially, whether they be the Palestinians today, whether they be the Kurds. I think we could go from a metaphor from, you know, the boarding schools. The idea, well, you're savage, but we'll elevate you. We'll take you through the layers of savagery to barbarism to civilization. This isn't rhetoric. Many of you will be very familiar with this language. And, you know, we heard it applied to the Celts. And so we'll make boarding schools. We'll declare you to be wards of the state, the Indian Act, Division of Africa, and when you become civilized, then you can become citizens. And I would say from the boarding schools to the International Monetary Fund. You know, the International Monetary Fund is essentially the boarding schools. You know, you're not quite ready for self-government. We can't quite trust you with your own visa card in the international community. We're going to have to discipline you into the credit and debt system. And of course, the credit and debt system, where does all of this credit come from? I mean, what was the value of transforming the Western Hemisphere into real estate? How much money was gained there? Now, when I hear about, you know, slavery and paying the descendants of the slaves, and they say, well, wait, come on, don't go back into history. Well, what about capitalism? What about hereditary capitalism? What about this huge amount of capital? Where does all this capital come from? So I think I might be, 15 minutes now, 10, 12 minutes. I really am going to try to discipline myself. Tate there, I'm going to change gears, but I'm going to come back to and set up Gustafson Lake, what happened. That tape is where I was introduced to the term disinformation and smear. In 1999, I saw this, and you see Sergeant Ryan there just casually saying, that can anybody help us with this disinformation and smear campaign? So that's where I learned the phrase. This tape was shown to the judge in Portland, Oregon, and in the case of USA versus Pittawanaquit, we won the case. We convinced the judge that Canada had violated its criminal procedures, its due process in law, and that it was politically motivated to criminalize one of the veterans of the Battle of Gustafson Lake. The judge agreed, after seeing the evidence, that disinformation and smear was committed by the government of Canada. So Splitting the Sky is going to lay out that story. But if I can take about 5 more minutes to lay out the background of these, you know, we hear the word native claims, we hear the words treaty. You know, it's complex history, and there's no getting away from the necessity to give some attention to the background of this. Now, okay, I'm going to put up here. This is, from what I can just barely see, this is a map from my book. The last thing I did was the maps. I really thought these configurations of territory are so unfamiliar that there has to be some help with the geography. So if you can imagine, after the Seven Years' War, after the British conquered a country called Canada, or some called it New France, So then Canada was incorporated into the British Empire, into British North America. So this is like a decade and a half before the American Revolution. And in a document called the Royal Proclamation of 1763, King George actually reserved all of this territory as lands reserved to the Indians as their hunting ground. And if at any time any of the said Indians, and I'm quoting now directly from the Royal Proclamation of 1763, should be inclined, in other words, they have to agree, to dispose of the said lands, the same shall be purchased for us, meaning King George III and his royal heirs, in our name at some public meeting. So this is the rule of law. This is the post-conquest rule of law in British North America. And the phrase that I read from the Declaration of Independence, it was drafted by Thomas Jefferson. So when Jefferson is accusing King George of bringing on the merciless Indian savages, this is definitely what he's got in mind. That King George is actually in an incomplete and, you know, not full and not fully realized way, but nevertheless is acknowledging some kind of Aboriginal right, that Indigenous peoples are going to be included in the British Empire, and that there's going to be some legal basis for that. And that becomes intolerable to the American revolutionaries, because of course this land is going to, you know, it's scheduled to be transformed into real estate, into private property. And so I'm speaking about the background of what we call the American Revolution. But the American Revolution was really a civil war within British North America. That's how it starts. And I'm arguing that that civil war really had a great deal to do with Aboriginal rights. And the fact that the Indian fighters, the revolutionary Indian fighters, a lot of their revolutionary policy was to take over the Indigenous people's lands. So, you know, flash forward to Iraq, flash forward to the concept that we can go in, we can conquer the Indigenous peoples, we can extinguish the Aboriginal title, and then, lo and behold, we can give them their sovereignty. Now, you know, sovereignty, if the United States is giving it to them, there's your perfect example of, you know, a client state. We're going to choose who the government is, we're going to have our hand-picked people, and then we will give them whatever powers. This is familiar in Indian country, very, very familiar in Indian country. Now, just a little bit more. So here is the treaties that were signed according to the Royal Proclamation. And you'll notice that in the Maritimes there are treaties, but those treaties aren't according to the Royal Proclamation. There's really no clear situation in terms of the land title in the Maritimes. They had peace and friendship treaties trying to keep the Mi'kmaq from joining, keeping with their Roman Catholic French allies. So there's no treaties in that part of the country. Then we have, you know, a great history that is a huge educational to try to teach this history of these negotiations for the land. And then you'll see there were no treaties made in British Columbia, because British Columbia has its own distinct history prior to coming into Confederation. So the fact that there are no treaties in British Columbia became an enormously huge issue since the incorporation of British Columbia, which is in 1871, until the present. And so at Gustavson Lake in 1995, the Sundancers there, who included great legal minds like Splitting the Sky, like the former Attorney General of the United States, Ramsey Clark, like Bruce Clark, who was persecuted and was subject to a horrendous campaign of disinformation and smear,